Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Brian Koberger, the criminology PhD student who was at a different university and who's from Pennsylvania, who's accused of murdering them, finally comes to trial. But the big question hanging over this is, what was his motive?
Vicki Ward, thank you so much for joining me.
You are very welcome, Andrew. I'm delighted to be with you.
I absolutely love your beat. I love all the stories that you cover. You get to cover all of these fascinating cases and figures in culture. And I want to start with something that's really hot right now, the Diddy trial.
Yeah.
What's your read on how that case is unfolding?
You know, it's a great question because, you know, as I say every week on my Substack, this case is a racketeering case. So it's not about, you know, clearly, and Sean Combs's lawyers have copped to this. He is guilty of sexual violence towards women. I mean,
there's video evidence.
Video evidence of that, but that is not what he is on trial for. He is on trial for RICO charges and for sex trafficking charges. So the government really need to paint a picture of a business that was propped up by the prostitutes coming across
state lines.
The, you know, one of the charges is arson. Did, you know, intimidating tactics, videoing these freak-off sessions and then keeping the videos and using those as intimidation to people who worked for him. And it's really going to be whether the government can prove that this was a commercial enterprise, where I think that this case lives or dies by. I mean, it's sort of a new tack for the Southern District to take, and I think it will be it's very important probably for the government that they win this. So we shall see. I mean, what I do know, I haven't been in the courtroom, Andrew, for the Diddy trial because I don't have time. I've got a book about to come out and I'm working on another book that's due next year.
Yeah, there are too many trials to keep
track of. Yeah. But I have sat through a number of trials and I sat through the Southern District successful prosecution of Ghislaine Maxwell, and that there were the sex trafficking charges, and what it all eventually, which they, and they won that case. And what it all basically comes down to is who the jury believes. You know, the jury sits there, a picture starts to emerge as one by one these witnesses give testimony. And you know, it's really interesting. It's only when the specific charges are then given at the end of all of that process to the jury that it sort of becomes clear what's really being asked for. And it's not obvious, you know, in the weeks and weeks of testimony that unfolds. And I remember being quite startled when I realized that after 6 weeks of testimony, quite harrowing, just as the testimony in the Diddy case has been harrowing, that at the end of the day, what the jury was specifically being asked to think about
in Ghislaine's trial.
In Ghislaine's trial was whether in one case a package, a gift, had gone from Jeffrey Epstein's office, had been mailed to Florida. And that was what the specific charge was. And it was, you had, because this package was an item of underwear, it was being sent to a minor. And it was the act of that going across state lines, if you believed this minor was a victim. I was having sex, you know, unwillingly as a child with Jeffrey Epstein. But you know, those are not the things that get drilled down on in the weeks of testimony. So, you know, the judge has said, I think this is going to wrap up on July 4th. He's not going to testify. I think they've made that quite clear, which is probably, given everything we've heard, very smart. So we'll
And everything I read about last week's testimony from Jane, this anonymous or witness who we don't know the name of, but she sat in court and testified about horrors and actually testified about his violence, notably his violence after the hotel tape came out. He was violent against her in 2024, which I just thought spoke volumes about who he is. And to me, that detail was quite remarkable. You would think that he would be on his best behavior when he's being investigated and this narrative is out there, but absolutely not.
You know, I will say this, Andrew, as you know, I have spent 30 years or more, you know, chronicling rich and powerful people. And it is true, you know, I in my observation, that once people reach a pinnacle, they, like Sean Combs has, they tend to live in a bubble. I mean, I think that's the picture that's emerging in his trial, that he created his own world, not dissimilarly from the way Jeffrey Epstein created his own world. Because when you have enough money and power and clout, you can do that. And in your own world, you begin to have a reality distortion field. You think you're invincible. And that's what leads to that kind of behavior.
Do you think there's any world where Trump tries to pardon Diddy?
Sure. That unfortunately is not a reality distortion field. I think, you know, these two guys know each other well. You know, when Trump went and you know,
they're both Queensborn moguls, yes, trying to make it in Manhattan.
Yes, and believe it or not, Sean Combs's community embraced Trump when he was just a New York real estate developer, because as you know, you and I, both New Yorkers, know, he was an outsider. Even as he was a very successful real estate developer, he wasn't accepted by New York society, and the Sean Combs community embraced him because they felt he wasn't part of the sort of corporate elite. And so when you go back and you see the two of them sitting side by side at dinners and hanging out together, images from 20 years ago, you know, would Trump pardon him? I mean, he's already said, right? He'll have to have a look at it.
Right. And there is a playbook, and we'll see if Diddy follows it. I'm curious more broadly, how hard do you think it is to prosecute these types of cases? I'm thinking of Weinstein as well, in a post Me Too world. It does feel like the pendulum has swung a little bit back, and it's no longer a given that these men are going to jail. In fact, Weinstein, at least with one of the charges, his trial ended in a mistrial.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right. And that's why I think it's quite important to distinguish the two. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, I'm completely speculating now, that the Southern District has made the Sean Combs trial about racketeering and sex trafficking, and not about Me Too. And I have wondered, in the wake of the verdict in the Harvey Weinstein retrial, if the whole thing was beginning now, if it would have had a very different...
I totally agree. I think he would have had a different media playbook.
Yeah.
And I think the jury, as we've just seen in his trial, would treat the case very differently. Yeah. And I don't know if he would have had as harsh of a punishment in terms of sentencing as he had the first go around. So it's all very interesting.
It is extremely interesting, and I think you are absolutely right. I think, you know, Harvey Weinstein is a is a shrewd guy. I mean, he's another guy, you know, I worked for back in the day at Talk Magazine. He's another guy who, again, I think, you know, lived in a bubble. I mean, I think I told you I went to interview him.
Yeah, tell me about that.
2019. Well, he phoned me up. So I'd written my book on Jared Kushner. And he phoned me up, you know, and it was a Sunday morning. I remember it vividly. And there was the caller ID was, you know, anonymous. So I answered my phone because I'm a journalist. So I always want to know who it is on the other end. And he said, Vicky Harvey here. I stayed up all night reading your book. You know, I've read every word of it. And I knew him well enough to know that he is a big, big reader.
And at this point, he's kind of untouchable culturally as a
Well, no, character. He had been charged. So he had been charged in New York and in California. But at that point, he hadn't yet gone to trial. It was spring. It was spring, early summer of 2019. And his trial began later. I want to say it was.
Right, because he went to jail right at the turn of COVID, I believe, in March of 2020.
So...
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
But he's in hiding at this point. There's not many people have spoken with him, and he gives you a ring and...
No, he's completely in hiding.
Right.
No. He's invisible. So out of the blue comes his call. But and I should add that, you know, so I'd worked for him, but not directly as the executive editor of Talk Magazine in about 2000. So this is 19 years after that. But during those 19 years, and I had left Talk Magazine and gone to Vanity Fair in 2001, I think. And but in those 19 years, he had stayed in touch with me. And he had, I don't want to say every year, but fairly regularly phoned me up and asked me what ideas I had for books. And, you know, he said, you know, in his ideal world, he had Miramax Books at the Times would like to publish me. And we used to have very, very interesting and wide ranging conversations about all the books that interested him. And, you know, that was Harvey Weinstein at his absolute best. Somebody that, you know, most people won't be familiar with, but a very, very cultured man. I mean, there is a reason that Miramax produced some really fabulous
Academy Award winning films.
Yeah. And not mass market films. I mean, they were very, very tasteful and creative, you know, Shakespeare in Love, all of them. So anyway, so he phones up and he says, I've read your book. And he said, I hesitate to use the word. Cojones was what he would say. Because obviously I hadn't been afraid to sort of take on the Trump administration in my book on Jared. And so he's like, you know, I feel like you have the C word to take on, you know, the people who are coming after me. And it was a bit weird because he kept walking it. He was clearly, I think he was in his house in Connecticut at the time, and he was clearly walking around. So he would go in and out service, so we'd have to keep phoning back, which was slightly frustrating. Anyway, he basically said, I really need to meet with you. And, you know, of course, I'm
right, as a journalist, why wouldn't you?
I'm very curious to meet with him. So I ended up going to, I mean, because as you say, he was in hiding. So I was intrigued to learn that he had an office above Cipriani Restaurant in Midtown. Very, very high up, not salubrious offices at all, very small. But when you walked in, it was, you know, we were talking about bubbles and moguls creating their own bubble wrap world. The windows literally were papered over with newspaper. And even though I can't imagine how a member of the media would have got high enough to peer in, but that was obviously there, so nobody could take a picture.
Take a photo.
Yeah, exactly, of what was going on inside. And we sat down in this time capsule of a little office. He had one poor assistant running around. His name
was he bullying him?
Yeah.
Or her?
Judah, coffee, you know, I mean, this, that, and the other. And the walls were just full to bursting with black and white photographs of Harvey in his glory days, surrounded by every movie star you can name. Harvey and the Clintons. I mean, Harvey...
like a bad doctor's office with celebrity photos on the wall.
You know, in a way, whose office it reminded me of? Trump.
Mm.
Trump, you know, Trump's office in New York. Again, the walls. Trump's office is always interesting.
Before he had presidential portraits hanging on his office walls.
Before he had presidential portraits taken. Number one, Trump's desk had kind of lots of stuff on it. It wasn't...
as clear as the Resolute desk is today.
Free. No, no, no. And, you know, the famous Sharpie, because, you know, he would always annotate...
male journalists.
Yeah, well, he would annotate pieces of the newspapers and send them to people famously with his Sharpie. But so the desk had sort of had a lot of stuff on it. But the walls were also cluttered with, you know, every magazine cover, every photograph of Trump that must have ever been taken at that point. It was like a shrine to Trump. Same way, Harvey Weinstein's office was a shrine to Harvey Weinstein. And anyway, you know, in that meeting, it was a very long meeting. It was a 3-hour long meeting. And he, you know, basically went through all the women who were out there accusing him. And the one he was most upset by was one who had absolutely nothing to do with the court hearing, which was Gwyneth Paltrow. But he was very, very aggrieved that she had claimed that he had come after her because he had just paid her brother, Jake, a large amount of money in his mind for the screenplay of The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And I do remember him saying that, complaining about how awful the screenplay was, and saying, "And you can phone Donna Tartt and check with her." So you know,
so
I mean,
as he's under all this legal pressure, he's worrying about completely trivial matters and old Hollywood.
I think he's living in his own reality distortion field.
And I think he still is. I don't know if you watched his interview with Candace Owens.
So I did. I got halfway through it, Andrew. I did actually, because you told me it was interesting.
I did, but then I made sure to cancel my subscription after watching it. But he's in his own universe. I completely agree.
Yeah.
And you know, he'll still, even if the jury in New York found him innocent, he'd still be in jail because of the California case. Yeah.
Right. And the other thing to remember. And, you know, to bring up another delightful person, Jeffrey Epstein, is, you know, one does wonder, you know, let us suppose in a hypothetical world that Sean Combs walks out of that courtroom not guilty. And let's say Harvey Weinstein in some alternative universe was able to be not, you know, what actual life would they be returning to?
See, I think today actually you'd be able to... I think there's a lot of people in this country who hate the establishment so much that they would embrace these figures who the establishment has seemingly come after. Do you disagree?
Well, I think...
I don't think Weinstein would be able to make a movie in Hollywood.
No,
again.
That's my point, and that's what matters to him.
Right.
No, and that's what matters to him. That's what life is all about. For Jeffrey Epstein, life was all about being a concierge service for the 0.0001%. And, you know, without the ability to do that, what was his life? And, you know, for Sean Combs, I mean, people are not going to forget the videos, the video of him, you know, kicking Cassie Ventura.
Yep.
I mean, you know, people are not going to forget the horrific things they've heard in that courtroom. And I'd be very, you know, I mean, let's see what happens. But I can't, you know, I can't imagine that he's got many fans left, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I agree. And if he is found innocent, then he'll have a fraction of whatever business he had before. Switching gears, I want to talk about a case that you are very familiar with. We're about 50 days out from the Idaho quadruple murder trial. What's the latest you're hearing?
So the latest, you know, so as you know, I've got a book coming out on July 14th, The Idaho Four with James Patterson, and it is the definitive guide to what, you know, this upcoming trial on August the 11th. It's an extraordinary, horrific story of four college students at the University of Idaho who were knifed in their beds in a house in an area that was full of student housing in the middle of a night on a normal weekend, right after a big football match. And Brian Koberger, the criminology PhD student who was at a different university and who's from Pennsylvania, who's accused of murdering them, finally comes to trial. But the big question hanging over this is, what was his motive? Because certainly none of the friends of the four victims, Maddie, Kaylee, Zanna, and Ethan, knew anything about him. He has had a very, very good defense team, Andrew. He's got a pub, you know, it's actually the second case I've heard of in this week, you know, where the public defenders, you know, they can be good, they can be bad. Brian Koberger has a very, very good public defender called Ann Taylor, who, ironically, you know, this is Idaho. It's a very big state, but with a small population. And she actually worked for Bill Thompson, the guy who's the prosecutor. You know, so back in the day, they all went to the same law school. The case hangs, the evidence that
There's DNA, there's surveillance footage.
Well, so the key piece of evidence is the DNA that was on the sheath of the knife that was left behind. The knife wasn't left behind. The knife sheath was left behind. And they found this touch DNA, as they call it, on the snap of the knife. And one of the reasons the trial has been delayed so long, I mean, this trial is about to take place nearly 3 years after these four young adults were murdered, which is an extraordinary length of time for their parents and families to have sat there wondering why this man came after their children, and still not knowing all of the details of what happened to their children last night. I mean, that's the other thing I learned actually covering this, is that victims' families don't have special rights and they're kept in the dark by prosecutors to protect the investigation, and it's completely maddening.
I don't want to ruin your book, but what is your best guess as to Koberger's motive in the case?
Well, well done, Andrew, for getting the scoop. What my reporting shows, and obviously, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm going to tell you, you know, I'm sure there's going to be surprises in the trial. But I think that the role of social media and the internet is going to be very prominent and very pernicious. And this guy was very, very familiar with incel culture, not something I knew anything about, despite being the mother of two 22-year-old sons, you know. And they would joke about chads. I had no idea what they were talking about. But this guy studied it as an undergrad psychology major. He studied a guy called Elliot Rodger, who is considered to be the sort of founding father, for want of a better term, of the incel movement. And I think you're going to see that there are very striking similarities between the horrendous mass murder of college students that Elliot Rodger committed out in Santa Barbara in 2014, because, you know, this Elliot Rodger, for people who don't know, and there's no reason why you should, was a good-looking college student, came from a privileged background. His father was producer, director on the Star Wars movies. Elliot Rodger drove a sleek black BMW. But like Brian Koberger, he was a social misfit, He didn't have too many friends. Like Brian Koberger, I detail in the book, who loses his only sort of childhood friends to a drug overdose. He feels particularly cut off. Like Brian Koberger, he's in a university town surrounded by fraternities and sororities. Like Brian Koberger, he gets, you know, he never manages to have sex with any of the girls he makes overtures to. And so what Elliot Rodger does is he writes a book that's 160 pages long, telling the story of his life, which he labels his manifesto. And he gets that all ready. And he makes a series of videos sitting in his car with the sun setting behind him in the California hills, saying that he is about to go out and kill all the women who have turned him down. And he sends this video to his therapist, who then sends it to his mother minutes before he goes out and does exactly that. And the police come after him when he's driving his car, and ultimately he turns the gun on himself and dies. That's in 2014.
Did he kill anyone?
Yes. And killed dozens, injured. I mean, it was, you know, absolutely. And in fact, not just women, by the way. The first people he would meet went and killed were his two male roommates. Mm. So he went on a total killing spree. And that was in 2014. So before we get to COVID, right? And before you have men sitting at home, cut off from the real world, and sort of physical interaction becomes less and less, and online interaction becomes more and more. And so we know that Brian Koberger studied Elliot Rodger at DeSales University at length. And he was taught by a woman called Catherine Ramsland that the police who knocked on Elliot Rodger's door a month before he went out and did all of this, but didn't go into his apartment, which turned out to be a big mistake, because inside his apartment there was an arsenal of weapons. There were various character traits that, if you put them all together, would have indicated that he was about to go and do something this unspeakable. And when you look at all the character traits that Ramsland taught her class about, every single one of them would apply to Brian Koberger.
Interesting.
And what's interesting is that when he then moves across the country to Washington State University to do his PhD, this ought to be an extraordinary moment of success for a guy who's overcome heroin addiction, who's come from an incredibly poor family. This ought to be the zenith of a remarkable career. But the problem that he has is that, you know, he enters a criminology department at Washington State University that's run by women, quite progressive women, that teaches quite progressive subjects. And he chafes against the system again and again and again, which also, Andrew, raises questions about, not for the first time, about the role of the First Amendment, because Washington State University unquestionably saw his misogynistic behavior in the classroom and out of it. What they possibly didn't know, and what I do know because it's in the book, is that, you know, he articulated to one of his classmates exactly that he really didn't think women belonged on the campus, that women should be in the kitchen or in the bedroom.
Wow.
And he also told his classmate that, you know, he could go and have any woman he wanted. He could walk into a bar, and the whole thing was deeply unpleasant. So, and now, this is not coming from my reporting, you know, we know that his digital footprint online, this has been in the court papers, has some pretty nasty misogynistic stuff on it. So I think you are going to find that he was deeply, deeply familiar with incel culture. He was deeply familiar with Elliot Rodger. There are a lot of similarities to what happened in Idaho with what happened in California.
And what about the DoorDash driver
right.
that has just emerged?
Yeah.
Tell me about her. For those who don't know, you know this case better than anyone, but we had long known that one of the victims
yeah.
had ordered food and a DoorDash driver arrived 10 minutes before
yes.
Kohlberger began his
yes.
allegedly began his killings.
Yes.
Now for the first time through some sort of internet sleuthing, it's been revealed that we know who this DoorDash driver is,
yes.
and this DoorDash driver said that they parked their car next to Kohlberger. Can you fill us in?
Yes. You know, I think that the footage, right, has emerged of her because she was pulled over for a DUI, explaining that she's emotional and under pressure because she's got to give testimony.
In a separate case, in a separate matter, pulled over for a DUI.
Yeah.
Not on this night.
No. So exactly. And she explains to the police officer that she's under tremendous pressure and she's got to testify because she was the DoorDash delivery on the night of the murders. And yes, I mean, look.
I mean, don't you think we would have heard about that? Are you skeptical?
No, I'm not going to say too much, and this is not
okay.
in the book, but I wouldn't be shocked, Andrew, if you find somebody else saw Kohlberger that night. It's possible that the other roommate also saw him too. I think there's a lot we don't know yet. And the timing makes total sense. Because I mean the two events happened very, very closely on the heels of each other. So Zanna Kernodal orders the food. It arrives at 4 a.m. and the murders happen in a 10-minute period between 4 a.m. and 4:30. And
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Having, you know, I basically tried to drive in Kohlberger's footsteps and I, you know, walked in, you know, as far as I know, the where he went. So, you know, I parked my car where he would have parked his car at the back of that house. I couldn't walk across when the house was still standing.
The house was torn down.
Yeah. And I went with one of the students who's in the book who lived next door. And you know, it was very sad because she would walk around the back of this house. And every night, the one person's window you can see from the road at the back was Maddie Mogan, which is why most of the kids' friends believe it was Maddie who was targeted, and for reasons to do with her social media accounts.
And for those who don't know, she was ultimately killed, or she survived.
No. She was killed, and. You know, the belief of the friend group and of the families is that the other three were wrong place, wrong time. And in the case of Zanna Kernodal, actually the food, the DoorDash delivery, you know, tragically is what possibly cost her life because so Kaylee Gonzalez happened to be staying. She'd already kind of left the campus. She was graduating early. She'd moved her stuff out of that house. She was literally visiting for one night to show Maddie Mogan, her best friend, her car. And so in Maddie's bedroom, they had fallen asleep after a big night in the same bed. Zanna Kernodal and her boyfriend Ethan's bedroom is actually on the floor below. And he would have had to come past it on his way downstairs, and Ethan was asleep. The person who was awake, because she got a food DoorDash delivery, which Zana often did. That's what she liked to do after sort of big night out. It was, she happened to be up and on her phone, and she had been moving around on her phone on TikTok. And that, you know, this is in the court records. Dylan Mortensen, one of the surviving roommates, you know, heard a voice, you know, heard someone whimpering, and you know, and the guy, we assume it's Koberger, obviously he's pled not guilty, you know, saying I'm you know, I'm here, I'm going to help you. I mean, that struggle, I think it's fairly obvious, apparent from all the evidence, that was Zana, and she was the person who was awake and sort of mobile.
And all of this will come out in the trial, presumably in August, and we'll learn more about it. And your book comes out in July, which we're so excited about. I want to ask you before you go about some Epstein news that came out around 2 weeks ago. You're someone who knows this case inside and out, the Jeffrey Epstein case. Elon Musk tweeted suggesting that Trump's name was in the Epstein files. What did you make of that?
Well, I didn't think that was news.
Right, because his name is in the black book.
Andrew, my name is in the Epstein files.
Right.
I mean, anyone, and for no nefarious reason, other than I'm the reporter who had an epic battle with him. The you know, we all know that Trump and Epstein were friends until they weren't in the early 2000s. And, you know, we know that they had a falling out.
Over a real estate deal.
Well, yes, but Trump himself has never confirmed that. But the timing of it, you know, they both were interested in bidding for this big Florida Palm Beach mansion. You know, there are some things about that story that don't quite make sense, because the mansion was, you know, it was a bankruptcy auction. So all you had to do if you really wanted to get it was go to the bankruptcy auction. You know, I think that having seen the evidence all the evidence that was put out in the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, Trump's name was certainly someone whose name came up on flight manifests. You know, he definitely had been on Epstein's plane back in the 1990s, but never in a situation, never to the island, and never in a situation where one of the victims in the Maxwell trial, it was never one of the plane rides that was under discussion. With that.
So
go on.
Not really a there. It was more of a conspiracy theory that Musk was trying to stir up in this fight with Trump.
And I also thought it was pretty ironic, because the Wall Street Journal have reported, you know, I mean, the really remarkable thing about Jeffrey Epstein, you know, he was such a good bullshitter, for want of a better word, was that even after he'd been to jail in 2008, 2009, and when he got out, the fact that he could after that persuade Bill Gates and Elon Musk to meet with him, along with the whole, you know, the head of the CIA, all sorts of people, the fact that he was able to get all these people in a room, I think is really, really remarkable. And I still haven't kind of got to the bottom of all of that, but I don't, you know, I think if there was there with Trump, by now, in terms of the girls, it would have come out. And what I wrote about that I also find very interesting, and I'd sort of forgotten about, is that the person Epstein definitely would have known, because he made it his business to know all the models in New York, was actually Melania. And I myself sort of was thinking about this the other day, and you know, Melania was part of an agency that was represented by a guy called Paolo Zampoli, who's now, he's got a job in the administration, a sort of ambassadorial role. And Zampoli, I did know when I was reporting the Epstein piece for Vanity Fair many, many years ago. And Leslie Wexner, who was Epstein's benefactor, owned Victoria's Secret, and Victoria's Secret was Paolo Zampoli's biggest client. So, I mean, there are all wheels, you know, everything is connected.
Yeah, lots of names, yeah. But maybe
lots,
no firm.
Lots of smoke, but I don't know where the fire is.
Right. And what are you working on next? You have this book coming out. What are the other cases that you're following, and where can people follow your work?
Well, so thank you. Well, you can follow me on Vicky Ward Investigates on Substack. And, that newsletter tries to reflect all my interests, which are very, very eclectic, because I'm obviously very interested in true crime and the courtroom dramas. But I'm also, you know, I'm very interested in politics. I'm sure there will be another book about the Trump administration coming. I have got a very, very exciting new project, Andrew, with James Patterson that I'm very keen to tell you about, but we haven't announced it officially. We will be.
You'll reveal it first on this podcast.
Well, yes, but I can't put it this way. But
on a future podcast.
Yeah, on a future podcast. I think it's probably, I'm not allowed to disclose it yet.
Well, we eagerly await that. And your Substack is fantastic. I encourage everyone to subscribe. And I really appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.